So let's go into this from a bit of a chronological angle. What was your background before the Three Doodler? What were you doing before this came along and became such an important part of your work and the lives of so many other people?
So I won't go too far back, but suffice to say, I grew up in the UK and actually trained as a lawyer. And having done a year and a half of training in the UK, my law firm sent me to Hong Kong. And then after that, I decided to stay in Hong Kong, partly attracted by Asia and how interesting it was and how much was happening and how much innovation was going on. So after another 2 years of working as a lawyer in Hong Kong, I quit. I actually went to India for a few months and wanted to get on an entrepreneurial track, which didn't end up happening. And I went back into law. And then day one, sitting at my desk, I was like, what have I done? And pretty much a few days later, I decided to launch a software company with a friend of mine doing mobile phone apps. So we had one app called Last Night Never Happened, which, cute concept, deleted everything on Facebook and Twitter from the night before, but didn't really pan out. And then we got money to launch another concept called Echoa, which was location-based, and we were too late on the location bandwagon. But that's really what got me out of law and got me over to North America between the US and Canada. And it was during the demise of Echoa that I was crashing on Max's air mattress, probably overstaying my welcome when he showed me the prototype for the Three Doodler and said, what do you think of this?
So I was, well, I've done a lot. I used to work for MGM after on a really bad TV show called She Spies. And I went to college for computer science. I ended up in LA, which then led in a weird roundabout way for me getting a job in Hong Kong, working for a product development company making robotic kids toys and consumer electronics. And I did that for a number of years, which is actually where Dan and I met, was in Hong Kong whilst he was being a lawyer. And then I left that to do a bunch of other projects. I worked for a financial database company. And then after that, I did a robotics company that was a spinoff from MIT. And then I decided to go back into kids' toys. So Peter Dilworth and myself started up Wobbleworks in 2010. And we were making prototypes and selling them to toy companies when we accidentally invented the Three Doodler by working on a product called Trudy, which is a robotic dinosaur, which was 3D printing, missed a layer. And Dilworth said, hey, it's too bad you can't just take the top of the 3D printer, the nozzle, off of that and then use it to fill in the missing gap. Why can't you do that? And then we realized that you could do that. So we made a really quick and dirty prototype after scouring the internet to make sure that the product didn't exist. Since there were a number of items that we thought we were like come up with and then realized that something like that already exists, but it didn't. And so we started working on prototypes and doing that whilst still working on all of our other stuff. And then somewhere in there, while Dan was crashing on my couch, I showed it to him and said, do you think this would be cool to kickstart? Which he was like, yeah. I said, would you be willing to help me kickstart this? And he was like, sure.
I think I was like, yeah, this is the next Crayola. Who wouldn't want to help launch that?
But I originally had asked Dan for, I think it was 8 hours a week, something.
What yeah, was that it, was funny.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, I think it was 8 hours. It was like 8 to 10 hours a week or something, which within a week has become about 108 hours a week. I think that was the beginning of a theme that has lasted until now, which is like we always think we've taken on X, and then it turns out we've taken on like 10X.
When did you first realize that the Three Doodler was something that was really unique, that actually had something to stand out and not just a novelty? What was the moment where you're like, wow, we're really on to something here?
I think when we figured out how to use stencils, because we realized that it wasn't just about drawing in the air. I mean, the drawing in the air is cool. It's the wow factor, but it's not the practical application for it. The fixing things, the creation of things, which all tends to happen either on a flat surface or around an object. That was some of the more interesting stuff, because you could create things like Eiffel Towers faster and more easily than you could with a 3D printer. If you mm-hmm. don't have a CAD file, like if you had to generate your own 3D file.
Mm-hmm. So I guess for both of you, this was somewhat of a transition from, well, I guess more so for Dan, it was kind of a transition from a digital space to a physical space, where like you said, you're not dealing with files, you're putting together this physical product and putting it in people's hands, and you're letting them actually pull off the creativity. How was that? How did that feel to go from working in software to producing this piece of hardware that then enabled people to tap into all this potential?
I guess from my side, yeah, I was never doing the coding on the software. Like, I don't have that skill set. I had in mind was what the product was meant to look like, how it was meant to feel and work. But I wasn't the one getting it there, which was often frustrating. Moving into physical product in many ways was a huge relief because we knew what it was meant to do. Like, Max had a prototype and we knew how we wanted to improve it. And you can understand the physical, I think, a lot more quickly and a lot more easily. Like, I also had the benefit of coming from a family that did a lot of manufacturing. In fact, both my parents and my stepdad had come from manufacturing backgrounds. So even though I hadn't actually been in physical product creation before, in many ways it felt more familiar and it felt a lot more tangible. That said, you lose a lot of the huge benefits you have with software. You can't just push an update and fix a problem that goes wrong. Like, once you've shipped tens of thousands of products, you're stuck with the results of that no matter what. But yeah, I'd say overall, like, there's a huge satisfaction with seeing something that you pictured and you helped put together and you helped source minute parts of, and seeing it coming off the line and it working in someone's hands.
Mentioning repairs and updates, actually, we spoke to a couple artists who've worked with you previously, Rachel Goldsmith and Louis DeRosa, I believe is his last name. They talked about working really closely with you on developing and getting some advice on how to improve the performance of their units, and they were really blown away by the personal attention you guys gave them and their issues. Was that a philosophical stance you took? What led to you being that responsive to just a handful of users?
Service that we've tried to provide to everyone.
It's good that they think it's only a handful, because it was literally everyone.
Yeah. So especially like in the early days, I did all of the repairs of all the pens out of my New York office, which was my apartment. So for example, Rachel, the first time we met, she lives in Brooklyn. And I said, oh, well, I'm over in the East Village. If you want to meet me in a coffee shop, I will come and I'll fix your pens. Now, I've done that with a lot of people who happen to be in the city. And I was like, if you want an instant fix, like, you can meet me at the Bean on First Avenue between 10th Street. And I'll come and I'll fix your pen, like, right there and then inside of the Bean. But I was fixing, you know, hundreds of pens that people were having issues with, and they were all being shipped to my home, and I would repair them there. And I have phone conversations with quite a number of people to try and figure it out. And part of this was, we also wanted to know how to improve these things. And we weren't aware of how users were necessarily using it. Like, we had ideas of how you should use it and what you should use it for. But, you know, when you look at the work that people like Rachel and Lewis are doing, you're like, oh, that is something I didn't think of. Like, what else are you doing that I didn't think of? It's also how we discovered that, like, people weren't using it for, you know, an hour or two like we thought, but some people were using it for 6 to 8 hours straight, which changed some of our math in terms of, you know, how the device is meant to work after 3 to 4 hours of usage, that we have to keep it going, things of that nature. I mean, we've always tried to have good customer service. It's always been a very core value in the company, and we've always tried very hard to learn as much from our customers as possible. We work very closely with a lot of artists and support them as much as we can, because they're the ones that are making truly amazing things with our product. Our product just happens to be the tool that they're using to make those amazing things, and we want to see how much further they can push this stuff using our tool. I mean, this is a new industry. It's a new concept. 3D pens didn't exist until we brought them into the world in 2013.
Yeah, that last comment really hit it on the head. You know, there was always front of mind from the very first days of Kickstarter all the way through to now was that this is a product and a market in its infancy. And if we didn't get it right, we would not only be ruining it for our own company, but it would be ruining it for the whole medium.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, people had to have a good experience. And in the converse, we knew that if people did have a good experience, they would tell other people about it and the market would grow. Like our best advocates were going to be our own users having a good experience with this pen. So we you know, very carefully paid attention. And as we also realized that helped the product get better and helped the community grow, that kind of justified the efforts and we put more and more attention into it.
So you were both rather heavily involved in the early days. Do you think that being down in the trenches, so to speak, really gave you important insights and it has had an impact on the company culture you've developed?
I mean, I agree with that. I don't think like being in the trenches wasn't exactly like an option.
it was by necessity, of course. But
yeah, and I don't think any of us begrudged it or minded doing it at any point. And we're still very much like in the trenches in a lot of ways. I think that has more to do with just our personalities in general, that we like to be involved and understand what's going on. And then it makes us better at helping everybody else in the company to figure out what needs to get done and how to happen and how to help it make it happen.
Yeah. And I'd say now, like, you know, a quarter of the company is in some way devoted to either customer service or community building. And we touch base on a call once a week with everyone involved in that. And it makes us a better team and a better company. If we're not producing a product that's great for our users and we're not paying attention to that on a weekly or daily basis, then something's going a bit wrong. And we've seen people come into the market trying to copy us, and one of their biggest failings is quality and attention to that.
Is there anything you actually miss from those early days, or has it generally been an upward trend in terms of the quality of work and what you're able to do?
I've mentioned this quite a bit to people. Like, I miss the day when we were building a brand and building a company, but didn't actually have a company to run. That was pretty awesome. That was a fun bit. You got to imagine what the future would look like, and we've gone and built that future. And we've been pretty good to our word on like what we would build in what year and the rate we would grow at. But the demands on you and the type of skills you need change as you become a real company. And it definitely moves from being, you know, less focused on the creative side, more across to the management side. And it's, you know, it's a constant tension between trying to build a company where you can still focus on those areas while still managing what's going on.
And you would say you've met those goals pretty well. Are we on target for when the millionth pen was supposed to be sold from the first game plan?
Yeah, very much so.
That's great. What feelings does that number actually inspire in the both of you, that you're selling your millionth three doodler? What do you think is the broader impact of that? What do you think that means for the world at large in terms of creation and art?
That we should be trying to shoot for a billion.
Max has got a point. Like, at one point in time, millions, like, it's a huge number. And at the same time, it's like, well, how many crayons have been sold? How many
people have been sold?
So it's like, yeah, you know what? It makes us a legitimate medium. This is what it means, is this is not a passing fad. This is not just a Kickstarter. It is not a 1 or 2 year product on a shelf. This is significant and it's here to stay. So it's, you know, it's one of those simultaneous moments of celebration and realization that it's just the tip of the iceberg still.
Mm-hmm. So you don't think we're anywhere near having reached the full potential of either the creativity or the popularity of the three doodler, of the tool set you've created?
Oh, God, no. I mean, if you still think about it, as of right now, I would say maybe 10 or 20 million people know about the three doodler or 3D pens.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 100 million, and I'm being generous there. There are 6 to 7 billion people in the world. There's a lot of more people to just be informed of the fact that this device exists.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I'd also say we're still discovering new use cases where this could have a huge impact. You know, just this last week, we announced that we've been working with the Royal National Institute for Blind People in the UK. And, you know, 2 weeks before that, we're at an education conference in San Antonio, you know, launching a lot of our new initiatives for education and some of our new curriculum and our new bundles. And there are so many schools, so many subjects, so many students that could benefit from this. And we have scratched a tiny part of the surface on that. So this has a very long way to go. Like, it's been a while since I've seen something which has application as a toy and, you know, a pro engineering tool and an educational tool. And if you do look at anything, you know, in those markets that has reached scale, it's numbers way beyond what we're doing right now. So this really is, this is infancy, and there's a long way to go.
Yep. These are definitely early days. But you know, you've still followed quite a path to get here. Are there any challenges, when you look back that you're particularly proud of overcoming in getting to where you are today?
Like, personally or as a company?
Well, you can share a personal anecdote, if you'd like to put that out there. That certainly fit in with the keeping of the peace. I was thinking along the lines of the company, but both are certainly welcome.
There are moments when I look back, it's like we started out in our apartments, and there are unexpected physical moments where you walk into an office and you're like, oh wow, like, we've created a company that can pay the rent and hire the people that sit in this office space. And that always strikes me. It's like every few months I walk into our office, I'm like, wow, like, this is real. And we built it. But I'd say the biggest achievement, or at least the biggest obstacle to overcome, has been building a great team. Like, I look back and finding and building a team of really good people who are great at their jobs and love what they do is not easy. And the more I look at what we've done, I realize how hard it is and how hard it must be for other companies. And we've done that. You know, we're sitting here now with like 37 people, 36 people after 4.5 years, and they are kick-ass. And that's a huge achievement. Like, I don't think I pictured that. Like, I pictured us doing huge sales, and I pictured us, you know, making a ton of money and doing cool things with the pen and creating new use cases. But I didn't ever really, I always underestimated the human element and what it would take to build a team. So that's for me the big piece.
Max?
I mean, it generally has gone as expected, which is probably the weirdest part. Because that's never, I mean, there have been lots of stuff that was unexpected, but the overarching theme has continued as we laid out at the beginning of it all. During the first Kickstarter, we laid out a 5-year plan. But I remember telling it to like reporters and stuff like that, and they'd be like, yeah, that's cute. You know, that'll never happen. And then we've done it all. I guess it's really just, as Dan said, it's like the building of the team. It's the actual doing of all the stuff that's the greatest challenge. Mm-hmm. You know, if any of this was easy, then we would all like have amazing, cool product companies or amazing, cool software companies or whatever you were into. It'd be really easy, but it's not. I mean, it's anything is never as easy as you want it to be, but at the same time, you don't want it to be easy, because then, it would make it less of a moment or less of an enjoyment, I think.
So, a couple of softballs here. What was the first thing you doodled?
So, the first thing that was doodled by Dilworth was an Eiffel Tower. Well, I mean, the first doodles were between Dilworth and myself were like straight lines up and spirals. But mm-hmm. The first like true kind of doodle was Dilworth made an Eiffel Tower, which then inspired me to make like a better Eiffel Tower, which is why I then doodled a whole bunch of flat pieces and then joined them together to make an Eiffel Tower and went, hey, this is like even cooler than I thought. Which is then what we did for the Kickstarter, is we just made a big one and it kind of got the idea across.
Mm-hmm.
But those are some of the first doodles.
Great. What overall do you think has been the most successful or the most impressive doodle to you personally that you've seen?
I mean,
that's a really hard one. Go on.
The cash can, what is it called? The Quaterra.
Oh, the Cash Guy. I mean, it's a full-scale Nissan Cash Guy that was done by a team of like 7 artists in the UK to like 600 hours.
I also think that Plastic Man is a very impressive and dedicated project as well, which is Justin
Mataraccia.
He is creating a robot that he's doodled, and it's a life-size humanoid that has moving joints and all that, and every aspect of the robot is created by hand using a 3D doodler. So it's got working eyebrows and eyes and a mouth that's motorized, obviously. It's got hands that kind of work. He's partially done with the hands. Got backbone, skeleton, ribs, legs, and eventually he hopes to have this thing walking around. And I don't doubt that he'll do it.
I'm trying to think of like the most artistically or technically impressive. Yeah, the dresses are up there. So many dresses. Like seashell, you know, the seashell dress is still amazing because it was the first time we'd seen a full dress.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's been improved upon by others, and they've used Flexi now. But as the first, as an audacious attempt to do a whole dress that looked model standard, that was great. I'd say Rachel Goldsmith's work and Cornelia Kugelmeier's work in terms of like artistic detail and artistic style are fantastic. I mean, they both are exhibiting their works in galleries at exhibitions of their own and selling it to collectors. So it is recognized, their pieces are recognized as art, as they should be.
Same with Grace Duprez.
Nikki Furman in the UK. Furman.
So in terms of effects, what do you think way down the line people are going to think of when the 3D doodler comes to mind?
I think we're entering kind of a new era of consumption as consumers, where it's more important that you're able to fix stuff and that you're able to repair stuff, and it's less about directly disposable stuff that we've been using, and that the 3D doodler represents this unique tool that will allow you to fix and repair and create your own stuff from scratch. And that's what makes it a unique kind of thing going forward into the future. I really do see it as it will be as ubiquitous as like the glue gun, actually even more so, because you're able to do more with it than what you're able to do with a glue gun.
That's interesting. So like the whole upcycling trend.
Yeah, exactly. That this is the beginning of the upcycling. Like, in order to upcycle, you need to like join pieces together. The 3D doodler is the ideal thing for that. And at the same time, you know, as we go forward, we continue to push forward on using more environmentally friendly materials. Like, our kids' plastic is home compostable, and the PLA plastic we use is biodegradable. We're going to continue pushing on that, not so much because that's what the consumer is necessarily asking for, but because we think it's the right thing to do.
Something you said is interesting. You said it'll become ubiquitous. And I mean, again, to get philosophical, you know, it's become ubiquitous when people don't think anything about it when they pick it up. It's like, what do we want people to think when they pick up the 3D doodler? Nothing is the ultimate answer. Like, what do you think about when you pick up a pencil or a crayon or a glue gun? You just think, oh, that's the tool I'm going to use to do this. In a sense, just being there the whole time and being invisible and something that people use without thought is the pinnacle, believe it or not. I mean, to get deep into it, I've always felt that if we can get 3D doodlers into kids' hands at a younger age, which we're now doing with the Start Pen, kids will start to think about how objects are built, how objects are made at a much earlier stage. And that could lead to whole reimaginings of products, which we're just used to seeing in a certain form factor. But if a younger, less restrained mind was put on it at an earlier age, it could be reimagined in a whole different way. And who knows what difference that will have in all kinds of areas, whether engineering, science, math, design.
So you said so far everything's been on the time scale you've laid out, more or less. When do you see this future of ubiquity of 3D printing pens, hopefully mainly 3D doodlers. When do you see that coming about, everything going according to plan?
I mean, it's a continuous like thing, right? It'll take 5 to 10 years
to really become that ubiquitous?
Yeah, we've always said, like, when will we have a 3-dude in every classroom, which I guess goes in hand with ubiquity as well. And yeah, we've always said like 5 to 10. Time's gone on. I guess 10, like within a decade, which is pretty quick.
Is there anything you want to get on the record? Anything you really want to make sure gets out there, or a particular anecdote that you may not have had a chance to bring up that you want to share, a favorite story from your time with the company, or even some more philosophical thought about the future or the present or the past?
It's one of those amazingly open-ended questions, which when you're asked, you never have an answer to.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. It's okay. We should have seen that one coming and had something ready. There was one comment someone made not too long ago, and I can't remember where we were, Max. And we were talking to someone about the fact that we don't have investors. And mm-hmm. then we like built a self-sustaining company from the word go. And the person turned and said, now I get it. That's why you get to make products, which are just cool. That's one of the things I'm still enjoying most about what we do. Like, if we decide something is really awesome and deserves to be on the shelves or in consumers' hands, you know, even if it's not like the commercial home run, if we mm-hmm. think it, you know, deserves a place in society, or it'd be fun for a good group of our users to be using, we'll go and make it. And we have the freedom to do that. And I think it's really unusual for any company, let alone a startup, to be able to have the kind of liberality to go and do things like that. But it's certainly what makes us fun. It's certainly what we've tried to do from the get-go. Like, not just make things that make commercial sense, but also make things that we would want to be using ourselves. Mm-hmm.